Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Does this have to do with, like, whenever we die, do you believe that then the consciousness doesn't continue, or do you believe it continues?
Continues. Continuum. You are you, and you just keep being you. It's like there's a guy in a very old car, and he kind of drives it down to the junkyard and sits in it for a while, and then gets out of the car, closes the door and walks away. The car is the body.
Right.
But you just keep going.
Do you think there'll be like a sense of awareness of the consciousness? Or do you think it'll be just more like a unity?
After death?
Yes.
Well, you know, here's what I have heard. Okay.
Yeah.
The body is real, real, real special. And you need to do your expanding of consciousness while you got a body. So they say, make hay while the sun shines. Start your meditation, dive within, transcend, experience that unified field, because that experience infuses it and you grow in consciousness. And what are you growing? You're growing your enlightenment. You're expanding consciousness. The human being's potential is infinite consciousness. Higher state of enlightenment. And in between, you know, lives, you can't do that. You might have some awareness, you might not, depending on how much consciousness you have.
Right.
You know, if you were super highly evolved, in between lives, you'd be just, boom, you'd be totally, you know, aware. Then maybe you'd have to come back one more time and finish the job. You're not going to get out of school until you graduate. But you can only do your work with the body. This is what I've heard.
Welcome, everybody, to AM Bite. I usually say happy heresies, but they are not happy. We are awake, and this is awake, and I'm glad you're here for this very special show as we honor one of the great modern Gnostics, one of the great shamans, and one of the great dreamers of our era, David Lynch, on a very special show. My name is Miguel Connor, and I'm very happy to have our guest today, and that is Chris Knowles. We did a great show on Neil Peart, which I still remember, and I still miss him. But Chris, welcome, and thanks for doing this. You're on mute, sir. You've been muted. Hold on. Let's get you on here. Oh, okay. So we heard him. We did our pre-show. But anyway, Vance, how are you doing? Or how are things?
Oh, things are pretty good. Really hit me hard when I heard David had passed. And, the situation down there in LA is horrible. And I guess it pushed him over the edge, you know, the smoke and so forth. He had to move. Because the smoke got to where he lived. I don't know if you've ever seen the Lost Highway, but you know that house that you know he's that the Bill whatchamacallit the first guy in Lost Highway with
Bill Pullman.
That's it. Bill Pullman. Yeah. Yeah. The Bill Pullman house, the sax player. And that house is one of the three houses in David Lynch's complex up there.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, but there's smoke. And so he had to relocate because he had emphysema, which is what got him. So for those who hadn't heard the details on that, that's what happened.
Damn the fire. Fire is the devil's only friend. And Chris, how are you? We can't see you, but we can hear you.
You can't see me?
No.
No.
I see a black square.
It says I'm in the show.
Yeah, you are. The show. But we only see a black square.
we saw you before when you were on. But with no audio. So
should I leave and come back?
Yeah, give it a try.
All right, give me just a second.
No problem. It happens. All right. Well, welcome everybody. We will be again discovering and honoring the life of David Lynch. We will probably don't worry about super chats or anything like that. If you have any questions or if Vance wants to share some of your own insights on the master himself, he will try to get to them. So let us know how you feel. And very happy to see everybody here to join us in this honoring, if you would. And at the same time, not much else for housekeeping. On Monday, Dr. David Litwa will join us to discuss his new translation of the Corpus Hermeticum. So, and he's got some amazing insights and revelations on his translation that changes the game a bit on hermeticism, which will definitely be insightful, will be useful if you are into modern, if you are into magic today. So that will be Monday with Dr. David Litwa. And then on Thursday, we got the Reverend Lee Barlow to discuss the Kelepoth. All right, Chris, now we see you. Can we hear you?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yay! Yes. Tommy, we can hear you.
Yes.
Anyway, glad you're here, sir. And Vance talked about David Lynch. How did it hit you? I mean, would there be a secret son without Mr. Lynch?
Probably not. No. No. I don't know. There's so much to say. I don't even know where to start, to be honest with you. I've got some notes here, but it kind of jumbled appropriately. since we're talking about the Duke of Dissociation, right? The Lord of Liminality, right? there's so much to talk about. Somebody who's had an enormous impact on my life, particularly in the later stages of his career. I think his best work, I think he discovered his real calling with Lost Highway. I'm not sure that's one of his better films, but it's kind of where he discovered what he wanted to say and how he wanted to say it. And I think you can draw a line from Lost Highway all the way up to Twin Peaks, The Return. And I think there's just so many through lines there. You know, I mean, my favorite film of his is Mulholland Drive. I did a big live stream on it for the Patreon, which is up now if you want to
I was there.
Drop by. But I loved Inland Empire too. It's the timing of it's just incredible to me because, you know, we are talking about basically the death of Hollywood, the death of LA, and it's been the death of a thousand cuts, but you know, the real big blows were the strikes and now the fires. And, I keep trying to tell people that it's over. And they keep disagreeing with me, like, oh, this movie did well. And so, well, all the other movies didn't, you know. Hollywood is still losing more than it's earning. Most people who've been in the business for a long time can't find work. Experienced people can't find work. Things are shutting down. It's very likely that we'll see at least one of the major studios shut down within the next couple of years, given the financials, you know. And David Lynch was really sort of like the, I don't want to say he was like the last Hollywood dreamer, and he became very, very alienated towards Hollywood, after Mulholland Drive. And, you know, he always had problems sort of getting his vision across. He did a lot of work on television, which I thought was kind of a detour. that first week of Twin Peaks was great. And then obviously when he wasn't involved in the second week, not very good. There were some great moments in it, but I think overall the people who took his place were not up to his par. He did that thing on the air. I think he just really had trouble finding his voice until, like I said, Lost Highway, I think, really kicked in and really established what he wanted to do. Don't forget that there was a huge lag between Lost Highway and the, you know, his previous big film, which was Wild at Heart, which I just watched again. And that's the movie you make when you're in Hollywood and, you know, you're getting successful and you're doing too much cocaine, I think. It kind of reminds me of the Kill Bill movies, you know. Very interesting, though. So one thing it did really remind me of, and it's something that always stuck in my head, is just how much it has in common with True Romance. And I wonder if True Romance was like a movie that Tarantino wanted to do Wild at Heart, but sort of do it right. But there's that whole Elvis through line, of course, since we're talking to Miguel here. But we had done a couple of years ago now, we'd done a live stream on Jacob's Ladder. And I think that movie really influenced him in ways that I think are kind of hard to trace, because I don't know if he's ever discussed it, but I think that movie had a huge impact on him. And I think it really, I don't want to say it determined the course of his career, because he always had his own input. He always had his own ideas and so on. But I think he just saw that film and realized that, you know, what he really wanted to do, which was just basically dream on celluloid, could be done. He probably thought that he could do it much better. But I think really the impact that he had, there aren't a lot of other directors, I think, did it as consistently, was to just put across the whole power of dreaming on screen. I think that the best example of that is Mulholland Drive. But I also have other sort of theories about it, Mulholland Drive, that I don't think there's sort of the easy take where it's just like, well, she's dreaming. The first half is her dream and the second half is her reality. And then she dissociates and kills herself. I don't think that's that simple, because you have to sort of account for that weirdo couple that she encounters at the at the airport. And then she encounters again. And when I was rewatching that film, I was like, boy, they look like a couple of old MK Ultra leftovers, you know? And I started to see that film in the context of like, what if this was a woman that she was being experimented on? And, you know, you always kill your lab rats when you're done with the experiment, right? And there is an interpretation that makes a lot of sense if you paste that on to your interpretation of that. Again, so the whole idea is that she's having this dream, the Hollywood dream, and that's why I say he's the last of the great Hollywood dreamers. But he also in many ways, Inland Empire is... I don't want to say it's a sequel, but it's a variation on the same theme. And, you know, if you want to talk about that film as we go along, because that's a film that confuses a lot of people.
Oh yeah.
Quite a bit. But I think that if you follow my interpretation of it, it makes a lot more sense, and we can go into that. But Twin Peaks, The Return, I wasn't prepared for it. I was going back and reading my old pieces on it, and I was thinking, like, I just was not ready for what he was going to do here. And, you know, I mean, it's basically an 18-hour movie. You know what I'm saying? So people are like, oh, well, you know, he really, after Inland Empire, his resume got very light. But, yeah, well, he made 9 movies at once. <You know? laughs> 9 two-hour movies at once. So, you know, cut him some slack. And then people are like, oh, you know, do it again. I was like, do people not understand art? Do people not understand, like, the life of an artist? It's like, that was his grand finality. That was the big finish. You know, it's kind of like Bowie with Black Star, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the great ones know when to leave the stage, I think. I mean, Bowie didn't really have a choice, of course. But I think there's a tendency too often in popular culture, particularly, that you've just got to keep it going and going and going past the point of absurdity. And I think that, you know, Twin Peaks The Return was just a very graceful end note, not only to the franchise, but to his career. And it really encapsulated all the ideas that he had been fooling around with. And I just think it's one of the most extraordinary works of art in American history, personally. I can't think of too many parallels to it. It's just astonishing. And it's just a feat. The accomplishment is just amazing. And just how weird it was and how dreamlike it was and how many moving parts there were and how many, you know, storylines show up in the first and second episode or whatever. And I just completely dropped, you know, like these characters will just appear. And you're like, I want to see more of that character. And then they're just gone. You know? So it's just an amazing work, but it does follow Dream. It really follows the logic of Dream, which I've really come to see dreaming not as just this interior process, this chemical process in your brain. I think it is an alternate reality. I think I don't want to say you enter into another dimension or anything silly like that, but I think you do enter into a reality that is just far more layered than the one that we exist in now. And I've really started to look at this reality as like shelves, you know, like a shelving unit. And they're just various levels that, you know, various parts of this reality that you put on different shelves. And I think Lynch is really the only artist that I can think of who really understood that. I mean, you can go back to the surrealists. I mean, I think maybe his closest corollary in the fine arts would be Max Ernst. Probably his closest there. But I just can't think of too many others. And he was one of the last great dilettantes too. You know, he was a painter and a cartoonist, and we can talk about all the music and so on.
Oh yeah, I'm going to ask you about the symbol later on.
Oh yeah,
connection right there.
Oh, huge! Really? I mean, he was so obsessed with it that he decided that he had to create, you know, an entire genre dedicated
dream,
to her. I mean, yeah, he was chasing that dragon his entire life. So,
yeah, for the audience, he wanted to use "Song of the Siren" for Blue Velvet, and he couldn't. And
he also wanted them to sing it in the movie.
Oh, in the movie. Oh.
So there was going to be a scene where it was I think it was Laura Dern's character's prom. She was still in high school. Her character was still in high school. And they were going to sing Song to the Siren at the prom. And there was this whole scene written up for it. And he was really upset about it. And I think, you know, He was a great recycler, as all great artists are. So I think the whole thing with the musical performances at the end of all the Twin Peaks: The Return is, you know, him sort of processing that, you know. And then we had like very, you know, dream poppy kind of things like the Chromatics and so on. A number of those artists. Again, he's just chasing that dragon his entire life.
He was indeed, except for that Trent Reznor right before in season 8.
Yeah, but that was episode 8, but how that was appropriate, you know? I mean, you don't want like dreamy sounds.
No.
I think the only bum note for me was Betty Wetter, when Betty Wetter came by and, shut up, Betty. Loser.
I didn't like Nine Inch Nails. You guys probably maybe like it, but I hated Nine Inch Nails. Although it really did fit Mr. C, you know, the whole thing. It fit perfectly, but
perfectly. Because I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, is he going to end the show? Because, you know, I'm like, he's just playing at the bar. It's like, maybe it's a 20-minute show, whatever. And then,
that was one of the most extraordinary episodes of television.
Oh, part 8. Made. Yeah.
Episode 8. Yeah. I think that. I literally have like my hair standing on end on my forearms right now just thinking about that episode. It was just
absolutely who doesn't love the frog moth, you know?
Frog locust. So it was two of the biblical plagues, right? The frogs and the locusts. But that whole thing was just absolutely mind-boggling. I just, you know, if you had a hidden camera setup, I probably would have been like this the whole time. Like, what the hell?
Drooling, a piece of drool coming from your mouth.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
But that's the thing with Lynch is that and we've talked about it. It's when, like, I watch Twin Peaks, the first season, or Blue Velvet, you're going, this is completely new. This is completely fresh. I have never experienced, like, somebody opened a new dimension of reality. Like, we've talked, first time you hear Jimi Hendrix or Eddie Van Halen, you're like, oh my God, I wish I could forget it and then go back and re-listen, because it's from another dimension. It's an alien invasion. And Lynch is one of those rare people who could do that.
I saw Blue Velvet at the Waverly in New York. And people were walking out.
What?
Not because it clearly wasn't because, you know, they thought it was a bad movie, but they just couldn't take the intensity of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that movie, people forget how polarizing that movie was. It was a very, very controversial movie because it was so extreme and so intense. And I actually had a couple friends of mine come down and we went and saw it. You know, I wanted to see it a second time. And both of them, like, their knuckles were white. They were just gripping the armrest of their chair the whole time, because it was just, you know, people forget that kind of impact because nothing like that had really been seen. And so this is really interesting because I have a couple of syncs with Blue Velvet that I should bring up. First of all is that I had met his daughter, Dennis Hopper's daughter, Marin, a couple times. Oh. I had my old boss was, I mean, she was friends with everybody. She was part of the whole downtown scene. And, you know, she would have like John Malkovich come up to the office or whatever. And so I met Marin a couple times. Very, very quiet, very shy, very plain girl, just very strange. But, you know, my boss had said that this is back about a year or so after that film came out. She said that was just Dennis doing Dennis. He was like that almost every night of the 80s before he he went into rehab. That was just the way he was. He wasn't acting.
He was.
You know what I'm saying? And so that was somebody who knew him personally. But so another thing, my first job in New Jersey, I was working at this restaurant, and it was a new restaurant, and there were all these people coming in. And one of my friends was a waiter, and he swears up and down that Laura Dern was like a hostess there for like a week and a half. Mm. And I do remember a tall blonde girl working the door, but I was in the kitchen. I was a line cook. So I never really got a really good look at her. He said it was Laura Dern. So I don't know.
That's when you were at that mobster place, right?
Yeah.
The Sopranos.
Yeah, the real life Soprano, real life Tony Soprano. So, yeah. But so those are my stories. But anyhow, yeah, I saw that movie and it just absolutely blew my mind. But the funny thing is that whole scene when they play Mysteries of Love, I was like, wait a minute, this sounds really familiar. What is he trying to do here? It's funny when I ultimately read that he wanted that to be Song to the Siren. I was like, yeah, I kind of figured that out, because when I first heard that, I was like, what's he trying to do here? Julie Cruz. And then he did that album with her. What is that? Floating Into the Night? Is that what it's called? That first album they did together is great, with Angelo Badalamenti and so on. So anyhow, I've talked too much. I'll let somebody else
talk. No. Well, here's a question I had for you guys. Yeah. Again, Blue Velvet really bought one theme that is pretty much almost prevalent in Lynch's movies, and that is that sort of Manichaean extreme light and extreme darkness, and how these two worlds connect. You see, I mean, Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks, and people talk, yeah, he's in love with this sort of idyllic America and Elvis, and he wishes, part of him wishes this was the heaven, the perfect America. But then there's the other part. The conventional narrative is that he lived in the Pacific Northwest, Montana, and he saw this America, and then he lived with his first wife in Philadelphia. And we all know how insane, how crazy Philly is. And that's the darkness. And he was like, America's bipolar. You guys think it's as simple as that, why he's, again, took this Manichaean stance in his movie?
I said the exact same thing in my notes here. I've written down Manichaean metaphysics. So.
Yeah, very Gnostic.
And it's funny because he loved Philadelphia. If you Eraserhead, all the whole atmosphere of Eraserhead came from what he saw in Philadelphia, that industrial dark gray, you know, puddles everywhere, you know, sort of messy trestles and cement and all that stuff. He did not shirk from anything, you know, that was dark or light or whatever. It's he tells us that when he meditates, he goes into the realm of pure consciousness and it's bliss and so forth and wonderful. But I've been reading, The Big Fish, How to Catch the Big Fish, which he wrote. And he says that even though, you know, when he meditates, he doesn't, you know, it's all, you know, light and positive and so forth. It doesn't mean that he can't express. It's just that he doesn't live it. He doesn't live the negativity. He just uses it in his art.
Well, I think he just, it's like high contrast, really. You know, it's like an artist who uses extreme contrast of color to sort of bring out, you know, when you use a lot of dark to bring out the light.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really what he's doing. When I was reading up on Wild at Heart, he was just talking about how this is like, you know, lovers in hell, you know, going through this hellish world, but their love is pure and true. I don't know if I mean, that movie is really, it's the term that I come away with is kind of like sophomoric in some ways, you know, it's like pure id, right? So, I mean, but that's really the arc of his artwork.
It's melodrama pretty much. it's a melodrama.
Well, it's, but don't forget that was very much part of the cultural vibes. Films like that were very popular at the time.
Yeah, early 90s grunge.
Yeah, there was that.
Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly. There was just kind of this weird Americana vibe. And of course, the Elvis, you know.
Cage, yeah. Too. Yeah, I think it was him and Cage wanted to pay their tribute to Elvis for some reason.
Well, you know, so do you, right?
Yeah.
Well, you blame them. But again, I think that's like that's the kind of movie you make when you have your first real flush of success, and a lot of people, you know, want to be your friend and giving you drugs and stuff. It seems like a cokehead movie, particularly some of the just absurd, over the top violence. I'm thinking that one scene with the William Dafoe character, you know, it's ridiculous, but
pretty gross.
But that's you know, the sort of the path of the artist. One thing that I was really thinking about, though, is that he reminded me a lot of Carlin. So Carlin had been around for a long time. And sort of been, you know, he started off doing stand up on Tonight Show and wearing a suit and everything like that. Then he went through this whole hippie thing, and then he gets sucked into the whole 80s sellout vibe and everything. And he comes out on the other end of it, you know, when he rediscovers his anger and so on. He rediscovers his rage and his cynicism. And I think that that's what really endeared him to an entire new generation. Right? People just watched those later stand up acts that he had done and just dialed, like really felt, you know, the righteousness of his rage. Now with Lynch, I mean, it's a different vibe, but he became like evergreen. There are very few artists who become evergreen. They're always hip. They're always cool. You know, new generations are always discovering them. You know, new generations of filmmakers, if there are such things in the future, are going to be influenced by Lynch. And I would argue that when people are working outside the system entirely and making movies on their phones and stuff, which people have done, that Lynch will really become a touchstone because he was such a pioneer with the digital video. All of Inland Empire was shot on digital video very early on. I mean, there were some films that were being done, but it was all like handheld. And he did that because he really wanted to just burn, you know, just shoot tons and tons of footage and just put it together, make it, have it make sense in the editing stages. So as we become more and more from the Hollywood establishment and that system, and everything becomes more diffuse and spread out, let's just say, I think that his influence is only going to strengthen. He not only became one of the evergreen artists, but I think he's going to become one of the Eternals. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Eternals are always very polarizing, aren't they? You know, not everybody loves Nick Cave or Swans or, you know, Johnny Cash or whatever. You know, I mean, the people who last and the people who really endear themselves to generations upon generations are always very polarizing artists. You know, there's always something kind of extreme about them.
Hopefully these people that, you know, are going to be inspired by David Lynch are not going to just try to copy it, you know, try to copy the superficial characteristics of his movies, because according to Lynch himself, his secret is basically a process, you know, and really it's kind of independent of what's going on around him for the most part. He brings up these ideas, you know, from the pleroma, so to speak, right? And he brings them up, and he doesn't mechanically put them together. He uses an intuition, and he goes with the flow of the production, and things happen. Like, for example, the Bob in Twin Peaks, that was a happenstance. Right. Yeah, that was, and rather than say, oh, that doesn't belong there, like, get this out, I'll edit this out, he went with it, and he said, that gives me an idea. He's constantly developing the ideas as he makes his movies or his art in general.
It's improvisation, really.
Yeah, improvisational
process. And that's really how, again, going back to Inland Empire, sort of like the least well-regarded work in his oeuvre, but I find it particularly fascinating, because I think a lot of what he was processing was his own anxieties in that picture. But, you know, all the great artists do that in all their work. But there's something very specific about that. But again, the timing of it, that we are at end stage Hollywood right now, no matter what people tell you. And people always argue with me, you know, and it's just like, well, listen, you know, if you weren't involved in some aspect of the industry, you probably really should just keep your mouth shut for a while, because, you know, I was working for Marvel Studios for 15 years and then my phone stopped ringing. So there you go.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things are definitely falling apart, and these fires are only going to make them worse. It is, you know, they can put all the fires and they can rebuild all those houses, which will probably take at least 10 years, by the way. But you can't restore the trust. I mean, people will not trust the landscape anymore. Mm-hmm. And so much of the film industry has moved to places like,
oh yeah,
Vancouver and Georgia and Pittsburgh.
Yep.
I mean, I'm actually hearing that they're building a movie studio in my town.
Really?
The old, there's this huge complex where Verizon used to be, and they're going to put a movie studio in there. I'm like, wait, what? How's that going to work? But, you know, that's the reality of the business. So it is the end of an era, and everybody's, you know, 78 years old. That's, you know, we should all be so lucky. That's a good ripe age to go out, you know. I remember when I was a kid, guys would retire and they'd be dead a year or two later. So, you know, seriously, my grandfather retired and he was dead 6 months later. So that was very, very common. If you lived to seven, if you were a man and you lived to 70, you were like ahead of the curve. So 78 is a good age, you know. And yeah, he smoked, but he would probably tell you that, you know, quality of life is more important than longevity. You know, smoking was part of his
milkshakes, process. Coffee, all that. Yeah.
But he did love his quinoa too.
Okay. Yeah, well, at least he's not like Ridley Scott and Clint Eastwood that are just not putting out good stuff. And, you know, it's great they're working. More power to them, but...
You got to know when to quit.
Yeah.
The great ones know when to leave the stage. Yeah, yeah. It's really true. Because what you end up doing is you end up diminishing, you know, the work that you've done prior. And people forget why they found you important in the first place. So I think Lynch really had the right idea. Quit while you're ahead, leave the game when the stakes are up.
I don't know if he thought of it that way though, you know, because of the way he worked, I don't think he'd fit the normal, you know, progression of a career. Would his creativity stop because he got older? I don't think so. He was still trying to create. He was just using different media.
Well, that's the whole point. It's like, he wasn't trying to create another Twin Peaks or another big feature film. You know, he was doing whatever suited his purposes at the time, you know, sort of following his muse. I don't know how much of that work really made any kind of impact, but he did what he wanted when he wanted.
Right.
But, you know, knowing when to get out of the game is what I'm saying. Knowing, you know, to leave the stage is very important. You know, you can do whatever you want afterwards, but.
Well, you know, Angelo Badalamenti's death, I think really hit him hard because a large part of his, hang on a second, clear my throat. A large part of his filmmaking experience was sound and music. Mm. And his partnership with Angelo was very important. I think when Angelo went, that was the last, you know, if he did another film, he would have done it with Angelo. Mm. Since Angelo went, I think that pretty much was, you know, a big piece of what he enjoyed, you know, while making films is gone.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the great partnerships, really.
Yeah.
They put each other on the map, really.
Yep.
So, but Lynch, you know, could do his own music. Lynch did a lot of his own sound design. A lot of the sound design
you
see in a lot of his works are his own work. So, but again, the culture has changed. The world has kind of moved on. Show business is much different. Hollywood is dying. Old media is dying. We're at such a turning point. It's just amazing to me just how many things are just all of a sudden falling apart so quickly. I don't know how many people here read comics, but I just read that Diamond Comics Distribution, who were basically they were the only game in town for years. If you wanted to put anything out to a comic book store, you had to deal with Diamond. Right. They just declared Chapter 11. They're probably going to be out. Everything is just kind of dying. It's getting very difficult for bands to tour anymore. Touring was sort of the last resort after streaming took away all the record sales. We're at the end of so many different cycles, and it's sad in one way, but you know, the work will always be there. I remember reading when film was invented, you know, all these French philosophers had said, you know, we've conquered death. You know, no one will ever truly die because we'll be able to see them on film. You know, they will still live in this media. And just think about how primitive that was. And that's really kind of true. And now we've got AI. I mean, AI can just go through all the David Lynch interview footage that's ever been made. And just, you can have a David Lynch podcast for the rest of, you know, just completely auto-generated, right? So we are in this weird new world.
Start with the weather reports. That'd be easy.
Yeah.
Almost the same thing every day, right?
Yeah, like that was a joke, though. It's like doing a weather report in Los Angeles when the weather's always the same.
Right. Yeah,
he did Steve it, Martin though. Did a movie about that, yeah.
He did the numbers too. Remember the magic number of the day? I forget exactly what he called it, but when he had the balls and he described it, and he came, the number of the day is 7.
Well, I mean, he became his own product too, though. I mean, that's one of the things that is really unusual for a film director, particularly of his style and his stature. He did a lot of acting. I mean, he's in Twin Peaks more The Return than. More than Kyle MacLachlan is, you know, he's the real star, right? I mean, he's the main player, really.
Gordon Cole.
Yeah, he's the prime mover. I thought, you know, it's funny because he just kind of snuck that character in very slowly. And then all of a sudden, you know, he makes himself the star. I think he kind of liked the sound of his voice and, you know, he liked being at the center of attention, which is fine.
I wonder what possessed him to do that whole hearing aid thing, you know, with the, it was funny with the weird box, you know, hearing aid.
Do you know I'll tell you what my theory is. My theory is that he tried doing line readings and they just were not very good. And he realized that they weren't very good. So he goes, how do I work around this?
I made myself dead.
You know, I'll make a cartoon of it. That's kind of what I think really happened. I remember when that character first came on Twin Peaks, though, I was found it really irritating, though. It was kind of annoying. It's like,
but he was so well balanced by the other guy. What's his name?
The Miguel.
Miguel. Character. Yeah. Yeah. There was such
Ferrer, Miguel Ferrer.
Perfect balance. Both of them.
Yeah. They had a great chemistry and he passed away too. So
yeah.
After the return. But here's a question.
That's why not too long after he did that the return.
Yeah, I think he'd passed. By the time it came out, he was he'd left 2000.
Yeah, they had a
17. Right. But Chris, you're talking about Hollywood. I mean, Mulholland Drive is easily the best film of the 21st century. I don't think there's anything that comes to it. It's my favorite film. And I know it's now a meme on the internet, like people saying Mulholland Drive is my favorite because somebody said it. And of course, I've done plenty of video shows of you, of course, Vance. We have receipts. But anyway, it's my favorite movie too. But A, it's very Gnostic. And B, you can tell it's Lynch's huge finger at Hollywood.
Visceral. Oh, yeah.
It's just totally. Angry. You know, there's pain. He's being betrayed. He thinks Hollywood is Babylon. And he's just like, here it is. This is my magic. So he already like set the stage or saw it coming because that movie has it all when it comes to Hollywood's evil and ineptness and everything.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, you don't really have to read too much into that. I think it's all there on the surface, you know, especially the Michael Anderson character.
Oh, yeah.
Blowing all the strings. But I'll tell you something. I don't know if you've ever seen it. That was originally meant to be a TV series. Oh. And the whole tone and vibe and so much of it was so different than what it became. The TV series, you know, the Robert Forster character was much more of a player in it. He was basically the star.
Audrey Horne was supposed to be the Naomi Watts character.
Exactly. I mean, the whole premise behind it is that she goes out to Hollywood and becomes the starlet,
right?
And so on. But it changed. He had, you know, a bad situation, falling out with ABC. And that really, I think, informs the kind of dark look. But it's also, there's a lot of love there, too. I mean, he's got Ann Miller in it. And he's got Chad Everett. What other people in there? There's a lot of sort of people sort of wandering in and out from old Hollywood. He clearly loves old Hollywood. He's clearly in love with the romance of it. You know, he probably is wise enough to realize that that was always an illusion, but it was the very carefully stage managed illusion that we were sold for so many years. And I mean, I was in love with that whole romance. You know, I was much far too cynical to believe that it was ever based in reality, but it's incredibly seductive. And that is written into the film. I mean, I think there's almost kind of some of himself in the Diane Betty character as well, you know, kind of his own experiences. You know, there's a lot of subtext in there that I think it's kind of overlooked. And I think one of the themes or that we get clues in is that, you know, particularly with those weird characters that are talking outside of Winkies and everything, is that Diane washed out of acting and she became a prostitute. And that's right. Basically how she was supporting herself. But then there's this whole school of thought that she was, you know, she had been molested by a friend of her father's when she was young. And that was the chat. That was the whole thing with the audition and so on that mm-hmm. she went on. So there's a lot of subtext. And that's what I love. That's why I'll end up watching a movie like that 15, 20, 25, easily. 50 times.
Yeah.
Because you're always finding new layers.
Yeah, but, well, there's a scene like the inept assassin. I get the mood. I want to watch that scene because it's so ridiculous, but I love it, you know.
Well, but you kind of wonder, like, we don't really have access to his scripts and so on for the rest of the series. Like, what was that character about? But the way he worked it into the film is that she wanted to believe, she wanted to dream away the fact that she had this, her lover killed. Mm-hmm. So she dreams that, oh, well, that assassin that she hired, who, when we see him again, is clearly not inept and clearly not ridiculous. Yeah. He's a very scary, dark character. She wants to pretend that he
couldn't get the Clouseau job or something. Yeah.
but that's the great thing about that is that it is a dream, in, you know, even though I think there isn't another layer to it, but so much of it is a dream and works under that dream reality. And if you've done dream work, if you've done kept a dream journal and you start to learn how dream logic works, it's just astonishing. How he took basically was all this footage that was probably going to be another kind of flavor of a show entirely and worked it into this hallucinatory fever dream mind control narrative, you know, that is so layered. I haven't heard people say that that's their favorite movie, though. I mean, most of the people I know who are kind of your normie types or, you know, I don't want to say, I don't know, phonies or whatever, but people who say they like things that they don't actually like, I think that film's even a little too much for them. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I haven't seen those memes, so I can't speak to that.
Yeah, a lot of people couldn't put up with the ambiguity, you know, and the fact that, you know, you can't immediately follow the plot because it's kind of split, you know, it kind of segues. I think also Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway share a lot in that department because the dream, right? The Bill Pullman character, it's his dream that he was younger and so forth, you know, the second half of Lost Highway or like the middle. It's another, you know, I remember things the way I want to remember them. He even says that, right?
Well, the thing, the really indelible aspect of that film to me is the Robert Blake character.
Oh, I mean, God.
He's on, what is he, like 3 or 4 minutes on screen? To me, he's like the entire centerpiece of the film. I mean, everything about that film, in my memory, centers on his appearance. And ironically, since it's a movie about killing your wife, I mean, he was accused of killing his wife. So there you go.
I guess it must have been Bill himself, huh? His dark side. Must have, you know, that's one way to interpret it.
Well, I'll tell you, I've never really cared for him as an actor. So I think one of the reasons I never warmed up to that film is maybe as much as I should have. I mean, not that there's not a lot I don't find interesting about it, is that he's never convinced me in any role that he's played. This is just something.
You're talking about Robert Blake or
no? I'm talking about Bill Pullman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's something
he's
about
messing
him.
With Beretta. Why are you messing with
Beretta? Oh, Beretta, yeah, right. Keep your eye on the sparrow, boys.
Yeah.
There's just something about him that it just doesn't carry over to me. So.
Yeah, he's kind of blank, isn't he? And he's kind of like doesn't have a lot of spirit.
He's very bland him. And
right.
I don't feel like he really. You know, I don't feel like he invests himself in a role, that he's always acting, that he's acting, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah. No,
maybe that's why he was cast. I mean, maybe Lynch recognized that. You know, this is a guy who doesn't really throw himself into these roles, and he just sort of gets over with this kind of charm or charisma that he thinks he has. But then you have Balthazar Getty come in, who's a very different situation altogether, right? There's something incredibly dark about that. And then, you get the Getty fan. You know, talking about the fires, I mean, the Getty, the fact that the Gettys basically own California. They own Gavin Newsom and all these people. Yeah. They all work for him. I mean, all these families are very tightly interwoven and intermarried and so on. And the Gettys also have all that weird connections with Crowley and Kenneth Anger and the process.
Really? Crowley?
Oh, yeah. Oh, forget about it, man. That's a very dark, strange family. And I wonder if the kind of darkness and strangeness that lies at the heart of that family basically infected the rest of the state of California. I mean, the more powerful the Gettys became in that state, the darker and weirder and more horrible California became. You know, it's almost like one of those old fairy tales when, you know, an evil wizard takes control of a kingdom and the entire kingdom's under a curse. That's kind of how I feel about California these days. But I mean, the Gettys bankrolled, you know, Kenneth Anger's work in the 60s. They bankrolled Lucifer Rising.
Really?
But he also got money from the Ford Foundation. Yeah, he was really connected. Of course, he couldn't stick the landing because he's just too nuts, or he was too nuts. But he had a lot of powerful friends. Unfortunately, he burned every bridge that he ever walked over. So Jimmy Page, Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Bowie visited him. With Abba Cherry, even Bowie coked up, always within 50 minutes, he's like, I'm out of here, and left his house.
Whose house?
Anger.
All right. Okay.
Bowie visited him, and he knew he was full of shit within 15 minutes.
Wait, who knew who was full of shit? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, Bowie knew Anger was full of shit. And this is during when Bowie was coked up and doing his own black magic.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too, is that we're sort of at the tail end of the latest wave of the occult renaissance.
Yeah,
the occult, the cachet and the sort of the mystique that the occult had sort of taken on in the late 2000s has pretty much dissipated, I would say.
So, indeed,
and thank God for that. So.
Well, here's the question for you guys. I mean. What made David Lynch David Lynch? I mean, he obviously talked about depression and other things, but never really went into detail. His childhood seems to be happy. I mean, as you say, Chris, the muses pick the broken vessel. But what made Lynch Lynch? Do we know? I mean, I have a theory, but
suspects. I don't know. I've never really tried to psychoanalyze him too
Lynch
much.
Tells you. If you believe him, I mean, he was totally dedicated to art and the art life, quote unquote, the art life. And he really didn't compromise. He compromised way less than most, you know, directors, artists would, you know, and he didn't grow up being funded in his art, being funded very much at all. I mean, when he made Eraserhead, it was practically, it took him 5 years. You know, they lived on pennies. It was, you know, and he scraped and scrapped in that art institute, you know, like down in the stables. And he was really, quote unquote, slumming it, but it didn't bother him. He was happy to make his art with whatever he had available to him. So he wasn't spoiled, basically. And so that's one of the things that.
Well, that doesn't really account for sort of the incredible darkness that we see in his work, though, does it?
Yeah, because usually, well, I mean, whether it's Bowie or any, I mean, you're expressing some of your trauma, you're projecting your shadow and saying, here, in a way, I'm.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that I've never really gotten a sense. It seemed like he, whatever trauma or whatever he might have been through, that was sort of being processed in these films. I mean, he was very tight-lipped about, mm-hmm. and, you know, he chose to just put it all on the screen, but this, I mean, this clearly all his narratives are just full of trauma and full of broken people living on the edge of sanity.
Well, he admits having a lot of anger, you know, before he did TM, and he took it out on his first wife and so forth. And after he did TM, then, you know, the anger kind of dissipated. And, you know, pretty much according to everybody, he was a pretty happy guy. So maybe the fact that he chased away the anger on the surface, it still was seething underneath, because he says, you know, the pool of infinite consciousness has everything. And that doesn't mean just all the happy, blissful stuff. It has all the other stuff in it, too. So, you know, it has to come out somewhere. And he just, instead of living it, he put it in his art.
Yeah, I guess we just won't know. Again, he does mention, yeah, he mentions depression and other things, but he never went into detail like other celebrities, if you would. So,
yeah, it didn't come out in his autobiography. I mean, I read here's, I promised to show the Room to Dream here. I read this recently. Got it for Christmas, and it's Lynch's biography / autobiography. And it's interesting because the gal that wrote it, what's her name again? Christine McKenna. Christine McKenna wrote a biography for him, but every other chapter, David Lynch wrote an autobiographical description of that period of time. So it's a combination biography and autobiography. But really, there's not a lot of negative stuff in it, according to him. I mean, there's a lot of frustration and so forth in his trying to get his, you know, his art accepted and so forth. Maybe that's part of it. You know, here we are at Mulholland Drive again. But there's not a lot of like bad things that happened to him or whatever. I know it was very traumatic for him. His first child was very traumatic, and he wasn't really ready to be a father, and he says he wasn't a very good father, and that was probably what was behind Eraserhead and the baby. I mean, you can tell anybody that watches Eraserhead a few times.
I'm not even sure if it is a baby.
Really, the terror, the responsibility, right? Uh-oh. And then the wife skips out, right?
Well, I think Blue Velvet might be a sort of linchpin here. Because I think that one thing that can be traumatizing is when you're idealistic and maybe you're almost too sheltered growing up, and when your life is a little too pleasant, and then you find yourself in the fetid waters of reality, you know, particularly in the film business or in the art business. I mean, all the businesses that he wanted to make his mark in are just filled with the absolute worst human beings that ever walked the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. And I think that you could almost look at Blue Velvet as being Lynch's sort of autobiography of show business and entertainment. I mean, because who does the Kyle MacLachlan character fall in love with? You know, a nightclub singer. And the reality behind the visage, you know, the reality behind the glamour, and the reality is very ugly. And we kind of see that in that first scene you know, when we see this idyllic lawn and, you know, the suburban neighborhood, and then, you know, the camera just keeps zooming in, zooming in, zooming in. You see these hideous army ants, you know,
yeah,
all like struggling for purchase. So I think that that could be a major part of it. You don't necessarily have to have had a traumatic childhood to become incredibly traumatized by the world. You know, maybe like I said, maybe it's the exact opposite. Maybe that's what we do see in Blue Velvet and in Mulholland Drive. That people who come in sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed into a very dark and sinister reality that they have no context for. I mean, I think that you could very well argue that is the, you know, the underlying themes of both those films, which I think, you know, when all is said and done, people will see those as his best movies. So.
Yeah, well, we know his cosmology and cosmogony, so obviously he was very Gnostic, and obviously he came through it, without doubt, visions, studying Buddhism, all that. So, and yes, the singer, oh, Isabella Rossellini. God, Lynch had the best taste in women, right? Just starlet after beauty and talented, obviously. Naomi Watts was so young, but her performance is her best performance ever in Mulholland Drive. Just beautiful. Talented, very elfin, mystic women.
Well, you know, we were talking about Elizabeth and how she was supposed to be in that film, and it seems to me that was going to be his light to the darkness. So he was going to have this whole light show up with her singing Song to the Siren at this high school prom, at Laura Dern's character's high school prom. And that was meant to be his contrast with all this hideous darkness. I mean, little did he realize that, you know, it wasn't that much different in her life either. You know, he had no context for it at the time. But I think that became that whole scene when she's having this sort of almost like this enraptured soliloquy, and then we hear the Julie Cruz Mysteries of Love come in. So, I mean, he did want to contrast that at the end, you know, there was still this hope, you know, there were still these people, these younger people who weren't ruined yet, who weren't destroyed by the world yet. But I think at the end, you know, that bird, that fake bird, I think that was kind of like Lynch acknowledging that you can have, you know, you can sort of recreate the world after have it being destroyed by darkness and evil. But there's still going to be something missing. There's still going to be an anima. There's still going to be a life force, I think, missing. And that's sort of like that bird. I mean, I remember when I first saw that movie, and the entire theater just burst into laughter at that scene, you know.
But then there's when Isabella Rossellini hugs her son. She finally has her child. And that look of sadness is like, yes, I got my child back, but my soul is destroyed. How am I ever going to get back? It's
Well, one thing that really struck me about that film, and I, you know, I've written about this a lot and I've blogged about this, is that I sort of grew up in a town that was kind of similar to Lumberton, Braintree. And I remember, you know, a friend of mine called Braintree Twin Peaks East at one point because there was, I mean, and it's still happening now. And I didn't even realize it, you know, until about 10 years or so ago, when I got a subscription to newspapers.com, and I just started reading all these stories, and I just had no idea that I was living in that same kind of thing where, like, you're living in what you think is sort of like this, well, maybe not as idyllic, but you know, there was certainly a lot of surface darkness, but you had no idea that there were all these criminal rackets being run in these neighborhoods that you walk by every day. You know, I mean, there was so much of it, and I was just, to be honest with you, even though I was by no means, you know, Pollyannish about it, I was really struck by just how dark and corrupt and frankly, there was just a lot of evil in this town that I was growing up. So I could relate to that. And I think that's maybe why Blue Velvet just, you know, hit me so hard. I mean, it really did hit me like a freight train, that movie. And it was a lot of people as well. I was very disappointed. I mean, I do have to admit, I know that Wild at Heart has its defenders, but I was very, very disappointed in it. I thought that it was just a very lacking follow-up. And, you know, in some ways, I don't think he really got his mojo back fully until Mulholland Drive. So. Mm-hmm. Because he tried to compromise with a system that wasn't interested in compromise. You know, the Hollywood system is our way or the highway. Yeah. And he didn't understand, I think, since he had Eraserhead was a huge cult hit, midnight movie for years. And then he got The Elephant Man, which we didn't discuss before. I mean, Mel Brooks, people don't realize that Mel Brooks was the guy who put that all together.
Really?
Mel Brooks. Yeah. So
it was a big commercial success.
And I mean, it was a huge critical and commercial success. But then, you know, he falls in with Dino De Laurentiis, you know. And then Dune is a terrible, terrible disaster. So it all blew up in his face. You know, he's riding high. And then it all blows up in his face, you know, when it's supposed to be his moment of triumph. The thing that blows my mind, and I tweeted about this recently, or I retweeted about this recently, is that he was the first choice to direct Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
No way.
Yeah. And I really, really, you know, whether you do it through AI or whatever you do it, however somebody does it, I want somebody to do the David Lynch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, with all those characters, with Spicoli and the Phoebe Cates character and everything. And I have to see that. That's the next thing that I want to see. I mean, that needs to be made. And now that we have the technology and the AI and all this kind of thing, and he can, you know, we can cast Lynch himself as Mr. Mm-hmm. Hand and everything like that. So
I don't know. I don't think you can top that scene with Phoebe Cates in the pool.
Nothing. No.
No director could top that.
No, that is one of the greatest moments in filmic history that will never be equaled. So
yeah,
the song. Don't even bother. But you know, maybe you know.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten. And the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.